Blog Talk Radio.
Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media interview. The confounding thing about seeing your friends become successful is that while you're obviously happy for the good things that come their way, a tinge of jealousy and envy is not unusual. And that certainly captures my feelings about today's guest. Most of you won't know this man by name, but when you hear his credits, I think you'll agree with me that he's accomplished an awful lot. And you'll probably understand why I greet him with a touch of envy, at the very least. Kid Boss was a gangly young kid when I met him more than 20 years ago in the Clearwater Bureau of the St. Petersburg Times. He arrived as this year's intern, joining the staff for a time in search of real-life newspaper experience. Kid was an instant hit with the staff, funny, self-effacing, and extremely talented at capturing life's special moments in a way that the best journalists do. When he later joined the Seattle Times as a TV beat writer, Kit participated in a few critics' press tours in Los Angeles. He met several men and women who wrote for TV and started thinking, hey, maybe I could do that. And eventually, he did. So where, you're wondering, have you seen Kit's work? Well, his first job was writing a season for Bill Nye, the Science Guy, and he won a couple of Emmys for it. His next noteworthy gig was a big one, getting a story credit on the final season of Seinfeld. That led to a staff writing job on King of the Hill, which was then in its third season. Over the next 7 years, he rose to executive producer on that show. And when King was briefly canceled, Kit moved on, eventually landing a job on HBO's sitcom Lucky Louie, starring comedian Louis C.K. When it ended after just one season, he was asked to adapt the British series Creature Comforts for CBS. A Creature Comforts begins a limited run on CBS on Monday, June 4 at 8 p.m., which is why Kit is here today. Kit, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. Your voice is just dripping with jealousy. It's such a pleasure.
Well, and unfortunately, Kit, that introduction was so long, we're out of time.
Oh, I wish you failed to mention my hot wife, Bob.
Oh, well,
also that.
You'll send me a picture and we'll post it and share okay. Share with everyone.
It's really good to be here.
Well, that's great. You know, we've been doing Mr. Media now for a couple months, and no one has ever mentioned a hot wife before, so I'm going to be completely distracted for the rest of the interview.
They've got them.
Oh.
I've Googled those guys, and they've all got hot wives.
Oh, my God. Well, Kit, tell everybody about Creature Comforts and explain, if you would, why our mutual friends Tim and Bridget are really squeamish about its debut.
Gosh. Well, it is. It's such a cool idea, and I can say that because it wasn't mine. It's easy for me to say that. It's a sort of hybrid between animation and reality, a reality TV show, but more like an old-style documentary kind of show where we start with documentary audio that we gather from interviews conducted with just ordinary Americans all around the country. And then we take the audio and we set it, we animate it coming out of the mouths of plasticine animals that are done in 3D, or not 3D, but stop motion animation like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer or Gumby or more germane to this discussion, Wallace and Gromit.
Mm-hmm.
The same studio that does the Wallace and Gromit movies is the studio behind this show. They're the ones who first did it. Nick Park, the guy who's won a few Oscars, he was the one who came up with the idea and did the Academy Award-winning short in, I believe it was, I'm blanking. It was, I think it was in the early, the late 90s that he won an Oscar for that, and that led to a British series of the same name, Creature Comforts, and now it's crossing the pond, and we're trying to do our version of it for CBS.
Hmm. And I need to point out, in the interest of total disclosure, that if it wasn't for Creature Comforts, there probably wouldn't be a Mr. Media today, because Kit actually hired me as a field interviewer for the show more than a year ago, and that forced me to invest in a digital audio recorder. And when that assignment ended, I started thinking of other uses for it, which led to this interview series.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, so it all comes back to you, Kit.
Wow,
everything comes back to you.
On my shoulders. I hope your listeners or listener, whatever the case may be, appreciates that.
I hope so. Well, you know, journalism, you got to disclose everything these days.
What was that experience like for you doing those interviews?
It was hysterical. I wound up, this is a little inside, but I wound up interviewing, one of the interviews I did was friends of ours from the newspaper business, Tim and Bridget, and they were perfect for it. You know, of course, now you're interviewing me. I sat...
That's true. See, it's the old newspaper reporter in me. I just don't like answering questions. I'd rather be the one asking them.
Well, it was great because, you know, I know that there were a whole platoon of interviewers.
Yeah, we
and
had 40, more than 40 across the country.
Was it that many?
Yeah.
And you guys were great in that you gave us a website to look at or some discs to get familiar with the style and
right.
the way to do it. And I knew, having watched that, when I sat down with Tim and Bridget, for example, that they were going to be gold because they have interesting voices and they interact with each other. And I would be interviewing them, and I could be picturing in my mind that these two could be animals.
Yeah.
In a nice way. You know, we love them, but
it was a really interesting kind of slippery process because despite the fact that I mean they've got great voices and that's kind of where it starts. You know, we want voices that are filled with a kind of character that an animator can listen to them and just kind of imagine what a creature might be doing because we never see none of us ever see the people doing the interview. Everything that comes after that is sort of invented. You know, we invent what animal they are. We invent the situation that they're in. We invent their body language. And if you start with a great voice that has a lot of character, and, I can quite honestly say it's pretty rare. It's a hard thing to find someone who has a voice like that.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't have it. Most announcers, most journalists don't have it because they're trained to kind of take the edges off. But Tim had this great kind of southern Indiana drawl and a ton of attitude. You know, he had opinions about things, and Bridget too. And despite that, the really interesting thing is we only use one clip of their voices in the entire series. That's how much good stuff we had to choose from.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That'll put them at ease too.
Yeah, they only have to worry about that one. That's a really, really embarrassing 15 seconds.
Well, it was a great concept. My daughter, who's now 10, would have been 9, I guess, at the time, watched over my shoulder as I was watching sort of the training videos for how to do it,
right.
and the kind of thing we were looking at. And she and my wife just thought it looked like it would be hysterical.
Yeah, the original show, the series. I mean, not just the Oscar-winning short, which was 89, was actually when Nick Park did that. That's when he won the Oscar for the short film. The series was just hilarious. And one of the biggest challenges for the British show was getting across the idea to the viewers that these are real people. They're not scripted responses. They're not actors in a sound booth somewhere recording lines like every other animated show. It's just people who are spontaneously answering questions. And it's hard when you see the show to imagine that none of this stuff was invented. You know, it was just people kind of speaking from the heart.
And God bless each and every one of them.
Yeah, it's
really funny.
I mean, it makes me feel kind of sappy when I see the show and start to feel like, God, this is a great country, that there are all these people with these really funny points of view and these great regional accents, so many of which you just don't hear on TV because, you know, when actors do regional accents, they got about four or five that they choose from. And here you hear, you know, you hear the difference between someone who's from Mississippi and someone who's from Alabama or someone who's from northern Florida and southern Florida. So that just made me feel, I found that pretty fascinating myself.
Now, when we spoke a year ago and this was gearing up, full of enthusiasm, it's very exciting. But of course, and you've worked on animated programs before, the process is a long one.
Yeah.
And in this case, unfortunately, several things happened in the last 12 months that made this not perhaps not as happy an ending getting to air as
well,
it might have been.
I would say it was unhappy. It was a rocky road, you know. It wasn't a smooth process. We had envisioned, my hope was that the show would be a mid-season replacement for
mm-hmm.
CBS, and air in January or February. And we geared our production schedule to that, and we're ready to deliver the show so that it could air in January or February. And then a show called Rules of Engagement came along and was successful. I think it surprised a lot of people in how well it did. That's that show with David Spade and Patrick Warburton.
Right, because the world was ready for another David Spade show. We know that.
I'm not going to say anything about David Spade. Or he's got that showbiz show.
Yeah.
He's really, he does that second banana character really, really well, and people seem to like it. And,
right.
The show just was a really good fit for the CBS lineup. You know, it made a lot of sense. People who were watching Two and a Half Men stuck around and watched Rules of Engagement, and the good side of it is we're doing a show for CBS, which is the most successful, has the highest rated comedy on TV, and is, aside from the American Idol effect, CBS still may win the overall ratings for the year even with American Idol factored into it. So they're the number one or number two TV network. So it's a great platform to have a new show. And the downside of that is most of their stuff is working. They don't have a lot of holes to fill.
Mm.
They weren't desperate to put on a show to put our show on. So we kind of went on the shelf for a few months, and now we're going to air in June. Which I think all things taking everything into account, I'm perfectly happy with it. It means that we won't have to get as big numbers as we would have if we were on in February, just because fewer people are watching TV in June.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not so late in the summer that everybody's gone off on vacation and forgotten how to watch TV, and doesn't realize that there's actually fresh programming that does come on in the summer. So,
well, I could see that there's certainly two ways to look at a summer run. One is you're not competing with a lot of fresh programming.
Right.
On the other hand, there's the perception sometimes that CBS is just burning off something it's bought and may not plan to see it again. But you obviously have an upbeat attitude.
Yeah,
towards
I don't feel that they're burning us off. That's not the attitude. I think the people at CBS loved the original show. They loved the idea. They loved the things that they were seeing, and they're really they're really happy with the finished product. And there's a pretty impressive list of shows that debuted in the summer that went on to be really interesting, successful shows. Seinfeld being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Northern Exposure on the drama side. That was a big success story for CBS. That was a summer series. So it's a way. My take on it is it's a great place for programming that's a little bit out of the box and that's a little different from everything you've seen during the regular season. And I think there are enough viewers out there who are eager, who are hungry for those kind of shows, that they'll, if they find this, I think they'll really enjoy what they see.
Was the business side of Creature Comforts affected at all by the fire at Aardman and the dissolution of the deal with DreamWorks?
Nope, the DreamWorks deal was purely a movie distribution deal.
Okay.
That didn't affect any of their TV, their TV projects. And the warehouse that burned, I think there weren't any old Creature Comforts related sets or characters in there. It was mostly a bunch of old movie stuff.
Mm.
And regardless of that, all of the sets, the fire happened before we started production, and everything that we did on the show, was from scratch. The characters were all designed from scratch. There were maybe a couple that we used when we were in a pinch from the old series,
mm-hmm.
when we just didn't have enough time to build something new. But for the most part, all of the backdrops, all the scenery, all the props, which are all built by hand, you know, all these little tiny scale cars and toasters and mm-hmm. everything you see on the screen, shrubbery and I mean, I could go on, wicker furniture that they make out of telephone wire. It's crazy, the stuff that they build there. They do that all from scratch, so that didn't affect us at all.
Well, there, you know, one of the most interesting things about having, you know, made a very small contribution to this was learning about how it's all done behind the scenes. And I kind of wondered if, as part of this this airing on CBS, if the public would get any kind of behind-the-scenes peek at how this comes together, because it's just as fascinating as the show is entertaining.
Yeah, well, we've provided CBS with some behind-the-scenes stuff for electronic press kits or for however, you know, they might choose to promote the show.
Oh, good.
We shot a lot of that footage. I think will wind up on the DVD. You know, there's definitely going to be a DVD release of the show.
Oh, good, good.
And there's also, you know, for people who are really into it, the UK version of the show comes with a making of extra on the DVD, so people can check it out there. I hope, you know, one of my hopes is that the show is so built for for viewing in non-traditional places other than TV, whether it's on the web or on your cell phone or whatever, that I hope they're, you know, we've tried to stress to CBS that it would be great if they could promote the show across all those different platforms and give people who are really into it a way, you know, to go to CBS.com and see a little bit of footage of the making of, see what some of the characters actually look like in real life. Hmm. People always seem to be really fascinated with that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely, you know, it was definitely part of it. Whereas, you know, to see, you know, King of the Hill behind the scenes, well, it's a bunch of people standing at microphones.
Yeah.
Not the same as, you know, following. I think one of the examples from the British show that we saw was the interviewer interviewing somebody while he's wrestling.
Yeah.
That was just great, you know, and the sounds and
my God. They try to get, whenever possible, you know, we interviewed some people ice skating, you know, who are doing figure skating. We interviewed, I don't want to give away the joke, but there is a really, what I think is a really good gag involving a couple of guys in Beverly Hills who are wine, I guess you call them oenophiles, is that a wine aficionado?
I believe that is it.
They're doing wine tasting. And we took that and twisted it in a way that we hope makes it really funny when they become animals. So, yeah, when you can get those sounds of real life being lived, that gives the animators one more thing to animate to, you know, and that gives you some great possibilities for acting. The other thing that we do that I always found really interesting about the process is, you know, we get all these interviews, we choose the audio that we think is funniest, and then before we send it over to the UK, we do what's called live-action videos. Did you see that at all on the stuff that you saw?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. It's a big part of the process at Aardman. We actually act out the parts. We act out the scene. If for example, if Tim and Bridget are sitting there talking about art, you know, or they're talking about what attracted them to each other, two of us from our staff in front of a video camera would sit there or stand there and kind of lip mouth the parts, but more importantly, act out with our body language and our attitudes and our looks. And we send those live action videos to the UK as a guide, and then the animators, whichever the animator was who was directing that shot, would also act out the parts for themselves as a way to kind of understand, to sort of embody the character and kind of feel, you know, what the attitudes were and understand the action better. And that's why when you watch Aardman stuff, it's so incredibly lifelike and so full of character. The eye movements and the little head tilts and the little subtleties that are hard to get even if you're a human actor, and then to translate into these tiny plasticine characters, that to me is one of the secrets of why the show turns out so funny.
Okay, you've got this experience of many years on King of the Hill and now the Creature Comforts. King of the Hill, Simpsons, I mean, I believe the animation gets sent like over to Korea or somewhere to be done.
Yeah, they do the key, what they call the key poses they do in the U.S., and then they send it over to Korea to do all of the in-between frames and a lot of the drudgery. But yeah, the bulk of the animation on a show like that is done overseas.
And both shows, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, the process with Aardman, how different is it than the process with King of the Hill? Is one any faster than the other?
They both take about the same amount of time. I mean, you figure from the time you have a finished audio track, it takes about, you know, 7 or 8 months until you have the completely finished animation. The processes are different, and I won't bore you with the specifics, but the number that kind of sticks in my head that's pretty amazing for Creature Comforts is that a single animator working on a set who's animating a scene between one or two characters typically can shoot about 3.5 seconds of animation a week. That's not much animation.
No.
So it's, oh, I'm sorry, 3.5 a day, 3.5 seconds a day. Boy,
okay.
3.5 a week would be
wow.
really slow.
Yeah.
But 3.5 seconds a day. So imagine if you're an actor, imagine you're doing a movie and the director realizes, well, geez, I can only do 3.5, 4 seconds today. It's a really laborious process. And the big difference, I think, at Aardman is that they don't farm anything out. You know, they do it all themselves. And you really get the feeling that they're these incredibly obsessed craftsman artists who just love animation and who pour their hearts into it. And just the level of care and love and creativity that they put into stuff, their standards are so high. That's, I think, why their stuff turns out so well.
Hmm. Well, let me, I want to come back to animation in a minute, but I absolutely have to ask you about your experience on Seinfeld. Spike Feuerstein was your contact there, right?
Yeah, I was introduced to Spike by a friend we have in common, and Spike was one of the writers on the show from very early on, and he rose, you know, to become one of the co-executive producers or executive producers of the show. And at some point, I just got in touch with Spike and was, you know, interested in being part of that show because it was such a great show, and he suggested that I just pitch story ideas, that I just write down, you know, make a list of one-liners for the different characters, what might happen in a show as a way to maybe, you know, get Jerry and Larry interested enough to interview me for a job. And the job never happened, and I kind of forgot about it at a certain point because I, you know, got the job on King of the Hill. And then during the last season of Seinfeld, just out of the blue, I got a call from Spike, just a message on my machine saying, oh yeah, we used one of your story ideas and we're shooting it this Friday, so if you want to come and watch the taping, you know, it'd be, you know, be our guest, come on down. So I went there to watch this story that I'd completely forgotten I'd even pitched be shot, and it's not that exciting a Seinfeld story, since I didn't actually get that close to it, but I got my name among many others on one of the episodes in the final season, so that was pretty cool. I'm not surprising anybody by saying that's one of the best shows ever.
Oh, absolutely. Now the episode was called The Maid, I believe.
It was The Maid. Yeah, but it was the one where Jerry. The main story, not my idea. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was where Jerry starts going out with his maid.
Right. Right, and she starts doing less and less work.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But he keeps paying her. So
right.
It becomes a little bit of a questionable, you know, you're sort of wondering, okay, what this looks a lot like what you might call a prostitute, I guess, not a maid.
Yeah.
And then the story that I pitched was a George story where he just gets it in his head that one of the things standing in his way of being a happy, successful person is that he just needs a nickname. He needs a cool nickname, and that the name will sort of transform him. If people didn't think of him as George, but in this case, he decided that the name he wanted was the nickname was T-Bone, that he would suddenly have this cachet, and that, you know, women would melt, and he'd get promoted. And of course, it goes horribly wrong. The name he winds up getting is the name of a monkey, and hilarity ensued. But pretty much my pitch was that, you know, he decides that the name is key, and that he tries to get people to call him T-Bone, and it doesn't work out. And
do you remember any of the ideas that you suggested that didn't fly?
No, I don't. I'm sure I have a list of them somewhere, but it would be painful and embarrassing.
Now, it's interesting to me that you pitched an idea that they went for that was for George, because, and I hope you'll forgive me, but thinking back, I would say that you, years ago, looked a little more like Kramer, although you had Seinfeld's wit, without a doubt.
Yeah. What was the word you used? Gangly?
Did I say that?
Yeah. I think you're right. I was a gangly individual.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're a grown-up adult now, but...
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not ashamed to admit it. I've got a bit of a protruding Adam's apple. And, a face a bit like a hatchet.
Don't put words in my mouth.
You know, you said I was self-effacing, so here's...
Well, that's true.
But, yeah, I am, you know, I'm tall and kind of lanky, and I don't have the sort of physical comedy gifts that Kramer has, Michael Richards has.
Yeah.
But, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Were you going somewhere with
this? Well, no, I just wanted to listen to you talk some more.
I'm not an attractive man.
No. It was. I think the point was that it was interesting that they bought an idea that you had for George, although I physically connected you to Kramer, but intellectually connected you to Seinfeld.
Interesting.
I think was the point.
I feel like there's more George in me than any of those. I mean, George is just, you know, a prisoner of his own neuroses, and I don't know. I think my interior life is very George-like.
Really?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, Seinfeld has such swagger, you know, and such confidence as a character. You know, he has his neuroses, but they aren't debilitating. And George, I think, I tend much more towards the George.
Well, see, that leads to the final area that I want to talk with you about, King of the Hill, because this other mutual acquaintance of ours, when he found that you worked on King of the Hill, was like, I couldn't imagine anyone less likely to be writing for a show based in Texas.
Oh, really?
Than Kit, you know, and I, you know, I could, like I said, I associate your wit. I could make the connection to Seinfeld easily.
Yeah.
George seems a stretch to me, but Hank Hill, tell me about Hank Hill. I mean,
well, I immediately connected with Hank Hill and his kind of obsessive nerdiness about, you know, his he loves propane. You know, he's a propane dealer. He works at a propane that sells propane and propane accessories.
Right.
He loves nothing more than to think and talk about propane, and he has a very small obsessive world that he lives in, and I there's a lot of that in me, and I just connected to that. And also, you know, the Texas thing, to me, it was more a show about suburbia, or about those kind of in-between parts of the country that aren't really the countryside and aren't really a big city. You know, they're not the outskirts of a big city. They're just the kind of mini-mall land in between. And up to that point, I don't think any TV show had really captured that part of life. And I grew up... Oh, the other thing, I mean, Hank doesn't just love propane. He loves his lawn, and he loves his Dallas Cowboys. And, I mean, I grew up in a place where lawn care was a really big part of life, and where I spent most weekends on a riding mower. And there were a lot of things about Hank that I could really relate to. And even if they weren't things that were part of me, there were things that were very clearly drawn. I mean, as a comedy writer, what you're really looking for are just strong character traits that really, you know, give you a guidepost to where the humor is going to be in a character. And King of the Hill was filled with those kind of characters. So I found it really, really fun, really rewarding as a writer to work on that show.
Any particular? Now, anyone could look at IMDb and see which episodes you are particularly credited with, but what I'm curious about, is there any particular characteristics or threads that you added, having been there for so long and started so early, that you added to the Hill legacy?
Well, things were pretty... Hank doesn't change a lot, you know? Hank doesn't go through... He's still at Strickland Propane where he started, and... You know, he hasn't gone through any real big life changes. So Hank hasn't really evolved as a character, to his credit, because I think he's such a great character that doesn't need to change. Peggy kind of flits around a little, and I mean, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I think one of the episodes that I wrote was where Peggy goes to get the job at the Arlen Bystander.
Oh, right.
A little paper there.
Where they rewrite the press releases.
Right. And she winds up, she gets a column. She does like a home advice kind of column and winds up telling her readers that a great cleaning tip is to combine bleach and ammonia because you get the cleaning power of bleach and the scent, you know, the clean smell of ammonia, not realizing that she's just giving the recipe for nerve gas. a very simple form of nerve gas. So, I don't know, I may be responsible for, I don't think there were any accidental deaths that came out of that. I think there was a, you know, don't try this at home kind of disclaimer somewhere, or at least we didn't hear about anybody trying it.
Not yet, but now people can associate a name with that advice.
Now we can definitely try. Do not mix those two things together. It's a very bad idea. Otherwise, I don't know. I'm not one of these people. I don't have a great catalog of my own pitches or jokes. There are a lot of writers who can tell you, you know, the first joke that they pitched that ever got in a show, or they'll be watching a show and can point out, oh, yeah, that was my joke, that was my joke. And I can't remember those things. Maybe it's like a survival mechanism to, you know, not... I mean, keeping score like that seems like a terrible way to...
Well,
your life as a comedy writer.
I mean,
you're the best comedy writer in the world.
You make a great point, though, about the show in that it really, once it was established, it hasn't really changed.
No.
There's different storylines, but the character, the essence of the characters and who they are and what they are, you could watch, and of course it's in repeats all over, you could watch any episode on any day and it would feel consecutive with the last one you saw.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's a credit to Mike Judge and Greg Daniels, who created these characters that just there's such a richness to them that you can keep, you know, they're still, now they're back in production. They're doing season 11, is it, or 12, or I don't know.
Yeah.
And there's no sign of it slowing down. So,
but is it easier or harder to write for a show that's that set? I mean, you can't do a very special episode of King of the Hill, for example.
Right, no, we wouldn't want to. It's, I don't know, it's, I guess you reach a certain point where, I always watch The Simpsons and wonder, well, how do you write for The Simpsons and come up with an idea that hasn't been done without it going to just crazy town? And I guess they do go to crazy town a lot. There's that show always had a, the types of stories that they dealt with after the first several seasons. It's just it's a cartoonier cartoon than King of the Hill ever was. And I think that must be really hard when you've done 300. They're coming up on 400 episodes now. How do you? What story is there left to tell that that they haven't lived?
Now, Mike Judge obviously created the show and also voices Hank Hill.
Yeah.
Does that make him kind of tough on writers who are putting words in his mouth?
What makes it tough? He's a great writer for one thing, and one of the hardest things at King of the Hill as a writer was if you've written an episode, you help in the post-production of the episode. So you help edit the episode and you help direct the episode. You're at the recording session where the actors are doing the lines, and they do each line three or four or five times, and you're there to kind of direct them. Mike spends most of the year in Austin and has his own recording studio, and he'll just, you know, after the script is locked, he'll go into the studio and just run through the lines and do two or three takes of each line. And the most frightening, terrifying, the awful experience that I have as a King of the Hill writer is when you listen to the tape of Mike's takes and you're picking the takes, and he'll occasionally come to a line and you'll hear him kind of go, I'm not doing that. Or he'll under his breath kind of mutter about how he doesn't understand what that line is for, or what the point is, or why it's funny. And he's always right, you know, because nobody knows his character better than him. And he's the voice of the show. It's his sensibility. So it really is a cringeful moment when Mike does one of those, you know, where he won't do the line, or he just kind of does it in a way that makes it clear that you better come up with something else to replace it.
Well, we've got to wrap up, but I've got one more question for you. Now, you wrote episodes of King of the Hill that featured cameo voices by two of pop culture's most famous TV newspaper editors, Lane Smith, who played Perry White in Lois and Clark,
That's
The New
right.
Adventures of Superman,
yeah.
and Ed Asner, who played Lou Grant for nearly 20 years on Lou Grant and, of course, Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah.
Now, drawing on your vast years of newspaper experience, Bob and Joe and the guys here that you work with and all the other guys.
I actually named some characters after my old editors at the St. Pete.
Oh, wait. All right, then let's come back to that in a minute. But I need to know, Lane Smith, Perry White, Ed Asner, Lou Grant, who was tougher?
I think Ed Asner, I mean, in a knockdown, drag-out fight.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ed Asner for sure.
Okay.
I mean, Ed Asner could kick both our asses with one hand tied behind the back. So.
All right, and then let's come. All right, so you've named, we'll have to add this, you've named characters after real people.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I think there was, now my memory is going to fail me, but my two editors in the St. Pete, in the Clearwater Bureau, Bob Jenkins and Joe Childs, I think both of them wound up in that episode where Peggy goes to work at the bystander.
You know what? I was thinking that I remembered Bob Jenkins as a character, but I couldn't remember Joe.
Yeah.
But I take your word for that. That's got to be a little dicey.
Well, you hope in the end that the character's funny without making them feel like... It's almost never the case that you tie a specific trait from that person to the name. It's just you're always looking for names that are realistic and, you know, drawn from your own experience. And also, it's a way just to kind of do a little tip of the hat to somebody that maybe you haven't talked to for 20 years but is still part of, you know, part of who you are.
Mm. And Kit, while you're waiting to see how things turn out with Creature Comforts this summer, is there more animation in your future at this point?
Not at the moment. I'm thinking about some other ideas that aren't animated, but I don't rule out, even aside from Creature Comforts, doing more animation just because it's been so much fun.
Hmm.
So I could see doing more for sure.
Right. Well, Kit, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media this week.
My pleasure, Bob.
Folks, if you'd like to keep up with Mr. Media's Friday interviews, you can subscribe to the site via email at www.mrmedia.com. You can also subscribe.